Good morning, and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. My name is Chris Pesky. I'm the board representative for today's service, not Lynn Smith as listed in the order of service. I have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. The annual SEWUUC fruit and nut sale ends today. Orders can be taken in the social hall after the service. There are many delicious choices for baking, snacks, and gifts. More information is available in the order of service. Please join us after the service next week for our third Sunday nature outing. We will leave the church at noon and drive to Scuppernong Springs Nature Trail in the Kettle Moraine State Forest near Lake Ottawa. It's a beautiful hike, not long, and includes some interesting springs and other features. A campfire at Lake Ottawa, marshmallows and hot dogs will follow. To all members and friends of LCUUC, the World Religions Book Group, which met last month and talked about Judaism, will be meeting and will continue to meet each second Friday of each month. We'll meet next Friday, November 13th, and cover Christianity. Please read chapter 8 on Christianity in the World's Religions by Houston Smith. Please, Patty Walker will be facilitating. Any additional information, please contact Sonia Wickman or Patty Walker. The UU Thinkers Chess Club that begins today is open to children and adults interested in improving their game. Maybe there is a new overs-unders opportunity in our future. The kids say, bring it on, Al. More details in the order of service.
Which kid? Actually, I'm here to report to you on the overs-unders soccer game. I talked to Bjorn. He said, just say big defeat. I want you to know that in the past, the overs-unders games have been kept close for a variety of reasons. The overs this year did come as much improved. I could tell there was a larger intake of ibuprofen before the game. I did note that we're all much older as well. No disregard, Robin, but my impression is that the unders learn from the overs. In the past, and the overs-unders game goes back many years, but in the past, there was quite a disparity between size and age in the competition. There were a lot more unders than overs, but they were a lot smaller. To illustrate that, I'd ask Greg to stand up, but he's taller than me sitting down, so I guess we don't need to do that. So this year was a historic year because in past years the overs had never been, as Bjorn said, defeated. There is some discussion as to the final score. Some will say it was 6-5. Others will say it was 6-4. Others will say it was 5-4. The overs will say, going back to my point of the unders learning from the overs in their ability to stretch the rules, that they were excellent in their draft choices this year. We had three ringers on the unders team. I'd like to point out one of them was 18, which would put them on the overs side. So to sum it up, a couple of quick comments. I could not reach many of the unders. They're just gleefully walking around, smiling, and making expressions at all us limping overs. Helen would suggest that we need more over ladies. Greg said it was just sheer panic and terror out there. Evan wants you to know that in the past, where we didn't have as many skilled players as we did this year, we were able to really push the ball up on you guys. And I guess I'll just leave you with Rob Sewers. We laughed. We cried. It became part of us.
We are going to have our Thanksgiving dinner on November 22nd. That is two Sundays from now. And we need some volunteers. We need people to set up and clean up. And we need people to make some turkeys, potatoes. What else it goes into Thanksgiving? Cranberry sauce, vegetables, stuffing. Is it stuffing? Gravy. Anything else? And dessert, pumpkin pie, all those. So we would have a volunteer sheet in the hall, social hall, today and the next Sunday. And if you don't have enough, you will get a call from me or somebody else. Thank you.
I invite you to greet those sitting around you. If you are a visitor today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitors table in the foyer. There's a variety of information available on the table about church, our church, and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to anything that interests you. I'll be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you've been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member, I'd be happy to talk to you about that as well. If you are visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to the religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along and observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just outside the doors to my right and across the foyer if there is a need for child care during the service. If there are any visitors who are comfortable introducing themselves, now would be a good time to do so that we may warmly welcome you. Welcome. Welcome. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. At this point, please put your cell phones on silence mode. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring and thought-provoking. The title of our service is The Meaning of Compassion and is presented by Sally Pla and Kelly Cole.
I have a reading from John Donne's Meditation, number 17, first published in 1624. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away from the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if any manner of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
In your order of service, please recite the chalice lighting words. Are we going to sing them, right? Yeah. Please follow along.
Thank you all. I'm Sally Pla. I'd like to invite the kids to come up now for a story for all ages. It's okay. Hey, you guys. We have a story today called The Rainbow Fish. Have any of you guys heard that before?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's an oldie but a goodie. A long way out in the deep blue sea, there lived a fish. Not just an ordinary fish, but the most beautiful fish in the entire ocean. His scales were every shade of blue and green and purple, with sparkling silver scales among them. The other fish were amazed at his beauty. They called him Rainbow Fish. Come on, Rainbow Fish, they'd call. Come and play with us. But Rainbow Fish would just glide past, proud and silent, letting his scales shimmer. One day, a little blue fish followed after him. Rainbow Fish, he called, wait for me. Oh, please, could you give me one of your shiny scales? They are so wonderful, and you have so many. You want me to give you one of my special scales? Who do you think you are? Cried the Rainbow Fish. Get away from me. Shocked, the little blue fish swam away. He was so upset, he told all his friends what had happened, and from then on, no one would have anything to do with the Rainbow Fish. They turned away when he swam by. What good were the dazzling, shimmering scales with no one to admire them? Now he was the loneliest fish in the ocean. One day he poured out his troubles to the starfish. I really am beautiful. Why doesn't anybody like me? Well, I can't answer that for you, said the starfish. But if you go beyond the coral reef to a deep cave, you'll find the wise octopus, and maybe she can help you. The rainbow fish found the cave, and it was very dark inside, and he couldn't see anything. And then, suddenly, Two eyes caught him in their glare, and the octopus emerged from the darkness.
I have been waiting for you,
said the octopus with a deep voice. The waves have told me your story, and this is my advice. Give one glittering scale to each of the other fish. You will no longer be the most beautiful fish in the sea, but you will discover how to be happy. I can't, the rainbow fish started to say, but the octopus had already disappeared into a cloud of dark ink. Give away my scales? My beautiful shining scales? Oh, never. How could I ever be happy without them? Suddenly, he felt a slight touch of a fin on his back, and it was the little blue fish. Oh, rainbow fish, oh, please don't be angry for me for asking. I only just wanted one little scale. The rainbow fish wavered. Only one very shiny, small, shimmery scale. He thought, well, maybe I wouldn't miss just one. Carefully, the rainbow fish pulled out the smallest scale and gave it to the little fish. Oh, thank you very much. The little blue fish bubbled playfully as he tucked the shiny scale amongst his blue ones. And a rather peculiar feeling came over the rainbow fish. For a long time, he watched the little blue fish swim back and forth with his new scale glittering in the water. The little blue fish whizzed through the ocean with his scale flashing, so it didn't take long before rainbow fish was surrounded by the other fish. Everyone wanted a glittering scale. The rainbow fish shared his scales left and right, and the more he gave away, the more delighted he became. When the water around him was filled with glimmering scales, he at last felt at home amongst the other fish. Finally, the rainbow fish had only one shining scale left. His most prized possessions had been given away, and yet, he was very happy. Come on, rainbow fish, they called. Come play with us. Come be with us now. Here I come, said the rainbow fish, and happy as a splash, he swam off to join his friends. It's time now to sing our hymn number 126, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing.
Thank you.
Thank you. At this point in our service, it's time for the offertory. So the ushers will be passing the baskets around.
Now is a time in our service where we invite you to share your personal joys and concerns. If you do wish to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring a microphone to you. And state your name and your joy and concern, and we will light a candle for you. As always, I will begin lighting a candle in memory of all the conflicts and problems that have happened in the world, and today with the hope that compassion can help solve them all. From pretty much every religion and some lay thinkers as well, we have some quotations of the golden rule around the globe. So high school students, would you like to come up?
Okay, I have a quote from Schopenhauer. Compassion is the basis of morality. And from Matthew, in everything, do unto others as you would have them do to you, for this is the law and the prophets.
Okay, mine is from Hinduism, the Rig Veda. Let us be united. Let us speak in harmony. Let our minds apprehend alike. Come and be our prayer. Come and be our resolution. Alike be our feelings. Unified be our hearts. And perfect be our unity.
Mine's from Buddhism. Let a man overcome anger by love. Let him overcome evil by good. Let him overcome the greedy by liberality and the liar by truth.
Mine's from Mahatma Gandhi. Religions are different roads converging upon the same point. What does it matter that we take different roads so long as we reach the same goal?
This is by Mother Teresa. It is important that everyone is seen as equal. I've always said we should help a Hindu become a better Hindu, a Muslim become a better Muslim, a Catholic become a better Catholic. We believe our work should be an example to people.
From Waldo Emerson, the purpose of life is not to be happy. It is to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well. And from Leviticus, love your neighbor as yourself.
All right, my first one is a Taoism quote. Consider a neighbor's loss as if it were your own. And then from Rabbi Hillel, what is hateful to you, do not to your neighbor. That is the whole of the Torah. The rest is but commentary thereof. Go and learn it.
Mine is from Bhagavad Gita. Give freely, be self-controlled, sincere, truthful, loving, and full of desire to service. Show goodwill to all. And from the Analects of Confucius, what you do not want done to yourself, do not do to others.
From Tao Te Ching, therefore the sage puts his own person last. From Arthur Rubinstein, love life and life will love you back. Love people and they will love you back. Thank you.
Thank you. Now it's time for our centering hymn. It's number 123. I guess you get to stay seated for this one, right? Usually that's what we do. So back in the early fall, when the worship committee was sitting around the table in the back room there talking about what meaningful programming we could bring you in November, a little seed of an idea sprouted. Something special is indeed happening this month, on the 12th actually, in just a few days, and we thought it would be a magnificent thing perhaps to share and celebrate together. November 12th is Charter for Compassion Day. It's the first one ever. And so, what better time and what better place, we thought, to explore the meaning of compassion. Here's a little background history about the Charter. It started back in February of 2008 when a religious scholar named Karen Armstrong won a very special prize. Karen Armstrong is one of the most provocative original thinkers on the role of religion in the modern world. a former Roman Catholic nun who left a British convent to pursue a degree in modern literature at Oxford, she's written more than 20 books around the idea of what Islam, Judaism, and Christianity have in common, and around their effect on world events. Books including A History of God and Holy War, and a fascinating, insightful history of the phenomenon of fundamentalism. Karen Armstrong's meditations on personal faith, she calls herself a freelance monotheist, have sparked discussion and garnered worldwide attention. Now, in February of 2008, Karen Armstrong was the recipient of the annual TED Prize. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, Design, and it's an annual conference which brings together the world's most fascinating thinkers and doers in diverse fields of art and science, and they're challenged to give the talk of their lives in 18 minutes flat. It's a fascinating notion. People, thinkers from all around the world, come together and share their ideas and think big picture. And if you win the TED Prize, you receive $100,000, and much more importantly, you get to make a wish. You're given the granting of one wish to change the world. And when Karen Armstrong won the TED Prize in 2008, she wished for there to be the creation of a charter for compassion. And the wish really seemed to catch fire. Granting institutions and agencies got involved. There was an incredible amount of press coverage. Religious and lay leaders worldwide came on board, and a website was launched. And over the course of this past year, well over 150,000 people from over 180 countries have contributed their thoughts and words to the writing of the charter. A council of conscience was formed, including diverse religious and lay leaders. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was among them, I know. And they met in Switzerland to pore over all of these ideas and submissions and distill them all down into this actual charter, a document that can serve as a yardstick for people worldwide of every class, nationality, religion, or creed as a code for humanitarian behavior. And it is this document, this charter, that's being launched on Thursday. It's all about the golden rule. It's all about what our high school students just told us. It's meant to be a cry for a return to this central principle, which is so often overlooked in our world. It reminds the faithful that in the past, leading sages of all the major traditions insisted that the golden rule was the essence of religion, that everything else was only mere commentary. They insisted that any interpretation of scripture that led to hatred or disdain or exclusion was illegitimate. According to the Charter website, the Charter for Compassion website itself, I'm quoting, "Like the Charter of Human Rights, this Charter for Compassion is a yardstick against which the laity as well as religious and secular leaders can measure their behavior. The Charter seeks to change the conversation so that compassion becomes a key word in public and private discourse, making it clear that any ideology that breeds hatred or contempt, be it religious or secular, has failed the test of our time. Such a charter requires everybody to participate: atheists, Buddhists, Hindus, Christians, Jews, Muslims, everybody. Our polarized world needs to see compassion practically implicated, politically, socially, and economically, and show that in our divided world, which so often stresses our differences, that compassion is something we can all agree upon." Now, we have a very short video that was pretty powerful that we'd like to share with you now.
treat all others as we wish to be treated.
Treat all others
as
we wish to be treated ourselves.
Как ты хотел бы, чтобы другие относились к тебе?
This is an image of how the world can be.
We posted drafts of the text for the Compassion Charter online.
We then gathered together people from the five different major religions,
analyzing, writing, critiquing the language there to synthesize all of this into the powerful document that now has unified us all across the globe.
Bring compassion back to the center of religion, and from that point, activate the rest of the world.
The principle of compassion lies at the heart of all religious,
religious, spiritual, ethical,
духовные и этические традиции.
Human beings all over the world must be cared for.
We have information at our fingertips, and that information is pushing us to do something about what's going on around the world.
We are at a critical juncture in history. The environmental crisis, the food crisis, the financial and economic crisis. Something is fundamentally wrong.
We are living in a period of commercial globalization. What we really need is spiritual globalization.
If this idea appeals to you and you're interested in learning more about the Charter, I encourage you to visit charterforcompassion.org on November 12th and share in the Charter's first day of launch. There will be a list of all kinds of events worldwide in celebration of this notion, of this Charter. Today's service is listed on the site, by the way. Our church is sharing in this as a small part of a greater good we can all embrace. But that's not all. The practicing of compassion in our daily lives is the goal of all this attention. It's the goal of all these wishes and charters and websites and efforts. And each one of us can strive to attain that goal. I just want to leave you with a little story. When I was a tender young thing in my early 20s, I was working in Manhattan, and I spent a month apartment sitting for my friend Lee, who had an assignment overseas. So there I was in her apartment building in a pretty crummy area at that point in time, just outside the building. It was not so great there. But outside the building on the sidewalk, night and day, there was this kind of dirty guy, this like drunk kind of bum. And he would just be lolling around on the sidewalk all the time, laughing and singing to himself. And to be quite honest, he scared me. He smelled funny, and he was kind of crazy, and I'd rush past him in the mornings on my way to the subway, really afraid of what he might yell after me. Well, anyway, I used to dodge him around the corner and stuff so I wouldn't have to see him. I spent most of my month in Lee's apartment studiously avoiding this guy and worrying about Lee's safety, too, thinking if this was really such a great neighborhood for my friend to be living in. And when Lee finally came back, I was at the apartment to greet her, and she came in, and we decided we were going to go out for dinner and headed out. And lo and behold, of course, we had to walk past the sidewalk guy who was there. And to my surprise, he looked right up at her and he said, "Lee, welcome back." And he looked overjoyed to see her. And for the first time, I noticed his eyes. He had really beautiful blue twinkly eyes, and they were just glinting with joy at seeing my friend. And my friend Lee went, "Gus, how the hell have you been? How are you doing?" And he said, "I missed you, but, you know, I can't complain. We're getting along." And suddenly this scary guy wasn't a scary guy. He had been magically transformed into a human being before my eyes. I could see this change happen as I looked into his twinkly blue eyes, and I was able to see him as a person, a sad, down on his luck, in need of a cup of coffee person, for the very first time. Lee told me that she always buys him coffee. He asks for money every time she goes past him, but she won't give him any money. She scolds him. She said he'll only spend it on alcohol, so she buys him a cup of coffee. She did it right then. We went across the street, came back with a cup of coffee, and he asked her, did you put enough sugar in? You never put enough sugar in. And she's like, yes, yes. If you want, well, you want me to go back and put more sugar in the coffee? And they were sassing each other, and you know, we walked on to dinner, and suddenly this strange man that I'd been scared of for a month was a real human person. I think compassion means seeing with new eyes, or maybe it means seeing from the heart and not the eyes, reaching out to touch our common humanity, and the ability to do this lies within all of us every minute of every day. So this is our challenge given to us both from the Charter for Compassion and from deep inside ourselves. It's a call to each of us, one that we must be only too glad to answer. And now we have Kelly Cole is going to be sharing with us some wonderful and wise words from the Dalai Lama on the subject of compassion.
Yes, these are from Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th current Dalai Lama, on compassion. And he starts out in the writing that I actually got a lot from his website with one great question. And to him, that question was, what is the purpose of life? And he believes that the purpose of life is to be happy. From the moment of birth, every human being wants happiness and does not want suffering. Therefore, it's important to discover what will bring about the greatest degree of happiness. How to achieve happiness? Well, he starts by talking about happiness and suffering and saying that they can actually be divided into mental and physical categories. And that basically the mind is the more important part to looking at bringing peace, because our physical bodies we really don't pay a lot of attention to until we are ill or something happens to it that injures us or we're free of necessities that we have. And so he looks at bringing about mental peace. And he writes, from my own limited experience, I have found that the greatest degree of inner tranquility comes from the development of love and compassion. The more we care for the happiness of others, the greater our own sense of well-being becomes. Cultivating a close, warm-hearted feeling for others automatically puts the mind at ease. This helps remove whatever fears or insecurities we may have and gives us the strength to cope with any obstacles we encounter. It is the ultimate source of the success in life. As long as we live in the world, we are bound to encounter problems. But if we remember at such times that it is not just ourselves, but everyone who has to undergo suffering, this realistic perspective will increase our determination and capacity to overcome troubles. Each new obstacle can be seen as yet another valuable opportunity to improve our mind. We can strive gradually to become more compassionate. We can develop both genuine sympathy for others' sufferings and the will to help remove their pain. As a result, our own serenity and inner strength will increase. Our need for love. Ultimately, the reason why love and compassion bring the greatest happiness is simply that our nature cherishes them above all. The need for love lies at the very foundation of human experience. It results from the profound interdependence we all share with one another. If left alone, an individual will not survive. During periods of our life, especially when we're sick or very young or very old, we must depend on the support of others. Interdependence is a fundamental law of nature. Not only higher forms of life, but also many of the smallest insects are social beings who survive by mutual cooperation based on an innate recognition of their interconnectedness. All phenomena from the planet we inhabit, from the oceans, the clouds, the forests, the flowers, all that surrounds us, arise in dependence upon subtle patterns of energy. Without their proper interaction, they dissolve and decay. It is because of our own human existence. It is because our own human existence is so dependent on the help of others that our need for love lies at the foundation of our existence. We need genuine sense of responsibility and a sincere concern for the welfare of others. We have to consider that we human beings are not machine-made objects. We are not solely material creatures. It is a mistake to place all of our hopes for happiness on external development alone. Instead, we should consider our origins and nature to discover what we require. Now, leaving aside the complex question of creation, each of us is a product of our own parents. In general, conception took place from sexual desire and our parents' decision to have a child and the compassionate commitment that they had to care for you. Or for us until we were able to care for ourselves. Our parents' love is directly in our creation. We are completely dependent on mother's care from the earliest stages of our growth. According to some scientists, a pregnant woman's mental state has the direct effect on an unborn child. The expression of love is also very important at the time of birth. The very first thing we do is suck milk from mother's breast. We naturally feel close to her. And we see she must have love in us. She must have love for us to feed us properly. From the time of birth till at least the age of 3 or 4, loving physical contact is the single most important factor in a normal growth of a child. If a child is not held, hugged, cuddled, or loved, its development will be impaired and its brain will not mature properly. A child cannot survive without the care of others. Love is a very important nourishment. The happiness of childhood, the allaying of the child's many fears, and the healthy development of its self-confidence all depend directly upon love. Nowadays, many children grow up in unhappy homes, and if they do not receive proper affection in later life, they will rarely love their parents and will find it hard to love others. As children grow older and enter school, their need for support must be met by teachers. If a teacher imparts academic education and assumes responsibility for the student's life, his or her students will feel respect, and what has been taught will leave an indelible impression on their minds. Similarly, if one is sick and being treated in a hospital by a doctor, if this doctor evinces a warm, loving feeling and that the patient feels at ease, that desire is the best possible care for the curative of the patient. Inevitably, patients' feelings make a difference to the quality and completeness of their recovery. Even when we engage in ordinary conversation in everyday life, if someone speaks with human feeling, we enjoy listening and respond accordingly. A whole conversation becomes interesting, however unimportant the topic may be. From the least to the most important event, the affection and respect of others are vital for our happiness. Recently, I met a group of scientists in America who said that the rate of mental illness in their country was quite high, around 12% of the population. It became clear during our discussion that the main cause of depression was not the lack of material necessities, but a deprivation of the affection of others. One thing seems clear. Whether or not we are consciously aware of it, from the day we were born, we need human affection. It's in our very blood. We naturally gravitate towards it. No one is born free from the need for love. Human beings cannot be defined as solely physical. No material object, however beautiful or valuable, can make us feel loved because our deeper identity and true character lie in the subjective nature of the mind. Developing compassion. Some of my friends have told me while love and compassion are marvelous and good, they are not very relevant. They claim that anger and hatred are so much a part of human nature that humanity will always be dominated by them. I do not agree. Humans have existed in our present form for about 100,000 years. I believe that if during this time the human mind had been primarily controlled by anger and hatred, our overall population would have decreased. But today, despite all the wars, we have human population greater than ever. This indicates to me that love and compassion predominate the world, and this is why unpleasant events are news. Compassion activities are so much part of daily life that they are taken for granted, therefore largely ignored. On the other hand, if the mind is tranquil and occupied with positive thoughts, the bodily will not... Compassion contributes to good physical health as well. Because he was talking about the mind here, now he does bring up the physical part of it again, saying that mental stability and physical well-being are directly related. Anger and agitation make us more susceptible to illness. On the other hand, if the mind is tranquil and occupied with positive thoughts, the bodily will not easily fall prey to disease. It is also true that we all have an innate self-centeredness that inhabits our love for others. We desire true happiness that is brought about only by a calm mind. And since such peace of mind is brought about by only a compassionate attitude, how can we develop this? It is not enough for us to simply think about how nice compassion it is. We need to make a concerted effort to develop it. We must use all the events of our daily life to transform our thoughts and behavior. We must be clear about what we mean by compassion first. Many forms of compassionate feeling are mixed with desire and attachment. For instance, the love parents feel for their child is often strongly associated with their own emotional needs, so it's not fully compassionate. In marriage, between a husband and a wife, particularly at the beginning when each partner still may not know the other's deeper character, depends more on attachment than genuine love. Our desire can be strong that that person whom we are attached to appears good, and when in fact he or she may be very negative. In addition, we have a tendency to exaggerate the small positive qualities. Thus, when one partner's attitude changes, the other partner is often disappointed, and his or her attitude changes too. This is an indication that love has been motivated by more of a personal need than by a genuine care of the individual. True compassion is a firm commitment founded on reason. Therefore, a truly compassionate attitude towards others does not change even if they behave negatively. Of course, developing this kind of compassion is not at all easy. Let us consider that all people, just like oneself, want happiness and do not want suffering. Their right to overcome suffering and to be happy is equal to one's own. When you recognize that all beings are equal in their desire for happiness and their right to obtain it, you automatically feel empathy and closeness for them. As long as they are human beings, experiencing pleasure and pain just as you do, there is no logical basis to discriminate between them or to alter your concern for them if they behave negatively. It is within your power, given patience and time, to develop this kind of compassion. Of course, our self-centeredness, our distinctive attachment to the feeling of an independent self-existence, works fundamentally to inhibit our compassion. True compassion can be experienced only when this type of self-grasping is eliminated. But this does not mean that we cannot start to make progress now. So how do we start? We should begin by removing the greatest hindrances to compassion, anger and hatred. These are extremely powerful, and they can overwhelm our entire mind. Nevertheless, they can be controlled. If they are not, these negative emotions will plague us and impede our quest for happiness of a loving mind. It is useful to investigate whether or not anger is of value. Sometimes when we are discouraged by a difficult situation, anger does seem helpful, appearing to bring with it more energy, confidence, and determination. Here we must examine our mental state carefully. While it is true that anger brings extra energy, if we explore the nature of this energy, we discover that it is blind. We cannot be sure whether the result will be positive or negative. This is because anger eclipses the best part of our brain, its rationality. So the energy of anger is almost always unreliable. It can cause an immense amount of destructive, unfortunate behavior, acting in ways that are damaging to oneself and others. It is possible to develop an equally forceful but far more controlled energy with which to handle difficult situations. This controlled energy comes from a compassionate attitude, reason, and patience. These are the most powerful antidotes to anger. Unfortunately, many people misjudge these qualities as signs of weakness. They are true signs of inner strength. Compassion, by nature, is gentle, peaceful, and soft, but it is very powerful. It is those who easily lose patience who are insecure and unstable. So when a problem first arises, try to remain humble and maintain a sincere attitude and be concerned that the outcome is fair. Others may try to take advantage of you, and if your remaining detached only encourages unjust aggression, adopt a strong stand. This, however, should be done with compassion. You should realize that even though your opponents appear to be harming you, in the end, their destructive activity will damage only themselves. In order to check your own selfish impulse to retaliate, you should recall your desire to practice compassion and assume responsibility for helping prevent the other person from suffering the consequences of his or her acts. If the measures you employ have been calmly chosen, they will be more effective, more accurate, and more forceful. Retaliation based on blind energy of anger seldom hits the target. Friends and enemies. I must emphasize again that merely thinking about compassion and reason and patience are good, but they will not develop enough. You must wait for difficulties to arise and then attempt to practice them. And who creates such opportunities, but our enemies. So if we truly wish to learn, we should consider enemies to be our best teacher. For For a person who cherishes compassion and love, the practice of tolerance is essential, and for that an enemy is indispensable. So we should feel grateful to our enemies, for it is they who can best help us develop a tranquil mind. So anger and hatred are hurtful and harmful. And unless we train our minds to work to reduce their negative force, they will continue to disturb us and disrupt our attempts to develop a calm mind. Anger and hatred are our real enemies. These are the forces we most need to confront and defeat. It is natural and right that we all want friends. I often joke that if you really want to be selfish, you should be very altruistic. You should take good care of others. Be concerned for their welfare. Help them, serve them, make more friends. Make more smiles. The result? When you yourself need help, you have plenty of helpers. Only affection brings us genuine close friends. If you have money and power, you may seem to have many friends, but they may not really be your friends. They are friends of your money and power. When things in the world go well for us, we become confident that we can manage by ourselves, and we feel that we don't really need friends. But as our status and health decline, we quickly realize how wrong we were. That is the moment when we learn who is really helpful and who is completely useless. So to prepare for that moment, to make genuine friends who will help us when the need arises, we must cultivate altruism. Compassion and the world. In conclusion, I would like to make a wider point. Individual happiness can contribute in a profound and effective way to the overall improvement of our entire human community. Because we all share an identical need for love, it is possible to feel that anybody we meet in whatever circumstances is a brother or sister. No matter how new the face or how different the dress or behavior, there is no significant division between us and other people. It is foolish to dwell on external differences because our basic natures are the same. Ultimately, humanity is one, and this small planet is our only home. If we are to protect this home of ours, each of us needs to experience a vivid sense of universal altruism. It is only this feeling that can remove the self-centered motives that cause people to deceive and misuse one another. If you have a sincere and open heart, you naturally feel self-worth and confidence, and there is no need to be fearful of others. I believe that at every level of society, family, tribal, national, international, the key to a happier and more successful world is the growth of compassion. We do not need to become religious, nor do we need to believe in any ideology. All that is necessary is for each of us to develop our good human qualities. I try to treat whoever I meet as an old friend. This gives me a genuine feeling of happiness. It is the practice of compassion. And this again was written by the Dalai Lama. I at this point was going to go into some ways to cultivate compassion from Leo Babauta's website called Zen Habits, but it's kind of lengthy. So I think what would be best is if I just kind of leave this on the conversation table for those of you that wish to review it. But just kind of the one thought is that, you know, starting some of these practices and thinking of some of these things each day is a way to begin. And it can even just be a small thing of thinking of our neighbor and then growing larger into the world. I would like to conclude my little segment here with a commentary by the Maharishi Sadashiva Isham, who wrote this commentary on a sutra that was written by Patanjali about 500 years before Christ. Compassion does not mean suffering with, as has often been felt in the world. True compassion raises the consciousness of those who are less evolved. Thus, compassion is that emotion which connects humanity vertically together, for there will always be those who are less conscious and those who are more conscious than oneself. Therefore, compassion to the lesser evolved and compassion from the more evolved ties the entire human race together in an endless tapestry of forgiveness, atonement, and progress. Please join us now in singing hymn number 122, Sound Over All Waters. Thank you. looks like we do have a few minutes for our polylogue today, so we'd like to invite you to share any thoughts that you have on compassion, an idea, a quote, a story, anything that you'd like to share today.
I'm Barbara, and I want to give a special thanks to our high schoolers for their beautiful quotes. I just love them, and I'm wondering if there's any way we can put them together on a sheet so they'd be available. Mm-hmm. I'd even be happy to help in the typing. I don't have a computer at home, but I can do something here.
We can do that, definitely. In fact, we could put them on the website, I guess, or make a link, or we can get that to you for sure.
I promised Sally I would say something. I had a compassion episode yesterday, and it was interesting because I went to a 3-hour Tai Chi workshop in the morning, and it felt very kind of meditative, and it really sort of, you know, felt good and opened your heart, I think. And I just came home and started going about, you know, taking care of things, mundane things at home. And all of a sudden, I just stopped at the kitchen island, and I had this, like, I had to stop. And I just had this very intense sort of feeling of compassion for somebody who I don't even know. But I know, you know, through stories from some friends and family that he's really struggling, actually committed some criminal behavior that has affected a lot of people and has gotten a lot of people very angry and upset. And just, you know, it wasn't in my consciousness at all, but it just came to me, this sense of, you know, real feeling for his suffering and compassion and hope for him, because I know he has to clean up this mess, as well as the people around him are now suffering because of what happened in that whole circle of people. And I was just kind of surprised to have felt this for someone that I've only heard of. And I have to think that that capacity in that moment occurred because of my mourning, and how I know in Buddhism and other religions, a practice of meditation is so critical to developing openness and compassion. And I think that kind of little jolt that I had that morning allowed that to happen. So.
My name is Carlin. I didn't know about this Charter for Compassion, and I think it's absolutely wonderful, and I look forward to bringing it to the children at the Montessori School and presenting it to them. And I just want to encourage every adult in the whole world, everyone here who's listening, to be sure to communicate the compassion to children and to instruct them and not allow, you know, the children to carry out the negative messages that they keep getting, the, you know, I always say the Bart Simpsons in the world, who are, you know, to be rude is the coolest thing. And our children really, really need to get the message that that's unacceptable and that compassion is where it really lies. That's where cool is. But it's just such a pervasive attitude right now in our society. And our children have to hear and see and experience it as much as possible, the really wonderful feeling of compassion.
I'd just like to add to that, knowing I work with younger children, especially like age 7 and under. Children learn by imitation. They don't learn by what we say. They learn by what we do. So adding to that of exemplifying that compassion ourselves is really the way to teach the children.
Hi, my name is Alice, and listening today, I was just thinking what an amazing opportunity we have. And you know, I grew up when I was young, so that would be a long time ago. We didn't even believe China existed. Do you remember those days? There was no red China. It didn't even show up on the maps. And about 20 years ago, I asked a Buddhist teacher of mine, how is it perfect that this huge country hates Tibet? And he said, how else will the whole world learn about such a small country as Tibet? So we have such a rich chance to just let our heart shine.
Name's Al. I very much appreciate today's topic, and what struck me, which I thought worth sharing, is experiences in this congregation and the feeling of compassion that goes out when we're aware of someone else's pain or loss. And it's easy to see that we reach out. And it's easy to feel if you've been in that situation where others have reached out to you. But as I was reflecting through what was said, what comes to my mind is that we need to reach out with compassion before those events. We need to reach out with compassion to those around us that we know and to others that we don't know, with the general idea that there's need for that either before there is that pain and suffering or simply in a manner of awareness that there's good in doing so without any catalyst, if you will.
Hi, I'm Colleen, and I want to thank you for your story about going to the Tai Chi in the morning and then having the compassion experience. And I think what's important about that is that we all need to remember to take that time to center ourselves and, you know, do the meditation or Tai Chi or prayer or whatever it is for you, because, you know, we can all go out and do good works in the world and, you know, do all kinds of charitable works and everything. And inevitably, we end up with burnout and feeling overwhelmed, and we get frustrated, and then we start lashing out at people. You know, we go out and do wonderful things in the world, and we come home and yell at our spouse, you know. And we all do that. And, you know, I think that instead of having this kind of yo-yo of, you know, one minute being angry and the next minute being charitable, you know, that this taking that time to center yourself where you can stay in that place all the time instead of going up and down.
Duke, I think that point about, you know, kids repeat what they see was brought home to me when I was at a family picnic one time, and my cousin's two kids were pretty young, a boy and a girl, and they ran past us, and the boy, as they ran past us and we were talking, the adults were standing here talking, they ran right past us and he whacked her. And the mom reached over and said, "Don't hit, whack." I always thought that was kind of an odd lesson.
We'll take one more and then we'll need to finish up.
Hi, Mangel. From growing up, it was very anti-compassion in my household. It was a very violent upbringing, and to show compassion was to show weakness. And then, well, I got a shunt in my head to show how many blows I took. But to find compassion after the fact, to try and learn it when you've been taught the opposite your whole entire life, is so incredibly difficult. It really has been like a 20-year struggle to try and get to a place where I can feel compassion and not be irritated with people who are compassionate. And it's just been a struggle. And And I really feel I have this blessing that I can raise my children with compassion, having been lived through the lifestyle that I had, and to come from trying to be so tough and hard. And I remember I used to scare people with my presence. I was a scary person, and I'm not the scary person anymore. It's a long, tough journey. And as everyone looks at their children and that, they're teaching them compassion. What a great gift. What a easier life they're going to have. They're not going to have to struggle and be angry all the time. They're going to be able to be happy instead of pissed off. And it's a great, great gift that everybody here is giving their children. It's wonderful.
Thank you all for wonderful comments.
We have two quotations as closing words today. The first is from Viktor Frankl. We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man, everything but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And our last quote is from Zelda Fitzgerald. Nobody has ever measured, not even poets, how much a heart can hold. Thank you all for attending today.
There's one here too.